Hello, everyone. I'm Robbie Dorman, and this is The Serial Fanaticist, the podcast for fans of everything. Welcome. Today, I am joined by Andrew Bloom from the AndrewBlog.net to discuss the 2017 video game What Remains of Edith Finch. We talk about the narrative depth of the game, discuss each vignette in the game at length, and touch on the multiple themes running throughout each level of narrative. This was a spectacular conversation, and I highly advise against listening to it before playing through the game. It is an incredibly unique experience. Please don't let us spoil it for you. It's always a great time talking to Andrew. On to the discussion. Hello, everyone. I am here with Andrew Bloom to talk about some video game, well, a video game in particular, What Remains of Edith Finch. Andrew, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well. I'm a little more nervous about going on hunting trips or taking swings or flying a kite, but otherwise I'm in good shape. How are you doing, Robbie?
Yeah, it does. This game does inspire a little bit of anxiety about everything. I'm fine. I'm good. I'm happy. I'm happy I get to talk about this video game, which I think deserves more attention. It's not that it hasn't done well or gotten a lot of attention, but I feel like it should get more. I feel like it is a game I wish everyone would play. And I'm been wanting to talk about it ever since I played it, like, early, I forget when it came out, but I played it the day, I bought it the day it came out and beat it that night, which was, let's see, April, I think. So last April.
Almost made it a full year.
Almost a full year. But I beat it that night and I've replayed it. I beat it actually in the middle of the night on my Extra Life stream while no one was watching. It was by myself just playing this very sad game. While I was deprived of sleep.
That feels very thematically appropriate somehow.
It definitely heightened, I feel like it heightened the emotional impact of it. It made me feel a little bit more than maybe my first try. And I think I saw more because I took my time. Okay, What Remains of Edith Finch? It came out last year. It is a walking simulator, if you'd like to put, if you don't mind that as a genre definition. I don't think they've come up with much better than that. It's like, it's an adventure game to me. It fits into the mold of the old style click and point adventure games, because I think they just streamline that experience. I don't know why it requires more, like, adventure games aren't, they're not much maligned, by video gamers, but yet walking simulator is half the time used as an insult. That tells a story.
I want to say I saw it genreized somewhere as like an environmental simulator or something like that. Something with the word environment in the title.
Yeah, there's a lot of, there's a an environment exploration game, environmental mystery. Like, there's a lot of weird fringe genre descriptions about the type of game it is. Like, I find that, like, is half the time, like, one, if you played at least one of these games, you immediately understand what it is. Like, if I tell you it is like that, you understand, oh, okay, it's like that. It's like a storytelling game. And the other, it seems like either, like, you don't need to know that information aside from it's like this. And then two, it seems to be used by a lot of people to try and make it, to try and define it as not a game. These aren't, which I disagree with strongly. It is about Edith Finch returning home, revisiting her childhood home, and learning about the mysteries of her family's deaths. That's a quick synopsis of the plot, even though I don't think it does it very good justice. Andrew, when we did our Shadow of the Colossus podcast, I talked about walking simulators a little bit. I mentioned them about, because we had a discussion about storytelling in video games and how you do that. What's the best way? And you had never played one of these. Now you have.
Now I have.
Now you have. And I think that is, I don't know, it is a thing that I think makes this definitely, it is a, what do you think about, I think to start off, what is the video gamey parts of this game? Like, what do you think about that in comparison to a Shadow of the Colossus or any other games that are more gamey, that require, you know, to climb things, to shoot stuff? This game is it's more definitely, the mechanics are much more minimal.
It certainly has minimalistic mechanics, but what I like about the game and what I think puts it at a high level in terms of video games is that it uses those mechanics to tell its story, to put the player in the position of the characters in the game. And when I was a kid, I really enjoyed playing Street Fighter and Mortal Kombat and a lot of games like that. But a lot of the time, it felt like the mechanics of those games were a series of learning to press buttons as opposed to something that made you feel like you were a fighter or something that you were integrated into. Story is probably the wrong word for a game like Mortal Kombat, but integrated into the scenes that you were watching. And what's interesting about Edith Finch is its mechanics are pretty minimal, but it uses them every time to put you in the story. I suppose I should say this here. I presume we are spoiling this game.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there's I'm sure people listening will have already heard me talk about this in the preamble, but yeah, if you haven't played Edith Finch, go play it. It's a 2-3 hour game. Go play it first. You definitely don't listen to this if you haven't played it. It's worth playing, and the surprises and mysteries that are revealed in it are, I'm not understanding this, were profound to me in several times, and us talking about it do not do them justice unless you have experienced them prior. So go play that game and come back and we'll listen to us talk some more.
And I 100% agree with that. And I agree with it in part because of how it uses those mechanics. It puts you in the place of Edith Finch. It puts you in the place of the people whose lives she is experiencing vicariously through their journals and letters and other pieces of art. And the mechanics are a big part of that. You know, in the first story with Molly, it's not just that you are watching this person have this experience of being sent to bed without supper and then things advance from there. You have to control yourself as a cat going across these branches. You have to be the person clicking the button, taking the deliberate action in order to send a hawk or an owl down to kill something. And you have to watch it die in your talons. You have to have one hand on the arrow keys moving your character around and another in a fantasy world and another hand slicing fish heads to symbolize the drudgery and the fantasy that are taking place. Like it's a game that has minimal mechanics, but it uses them very well each time. And I think that's what I appreciated about it and what makes it gamey in a way that some games that have more complicated mechanics aren't necessarily as good at.
There's a story in Mortal Kombat. You're the Dragon Man, and you gotta go beat the Skeleton Guy.
The story in Mortal Kombat, as far as I could tell, was continue to put in quarters in order to fight the next guy, because that was pretty much the story that I got.
What are you talking about? It's deep lore I'm trying to think of the name of the Mortal Kombat.
It was enough for them to make two movies out of it, so it did. There had to be something there.
Hey, that first Mortal Kombat movie is good. It knows what it is.
I haven't seen it since I was 13 or so I don't want to. I believe you, but I'm skeptical.
Understands what it is, okay? It understands, like, in a way a lot of video game movies do not understand what they are. It is like, hey, this is a big dumb thing. We're okay with it. We're gonna have uppercuts and Sub-Zero throwing ice everywhere. It's fine. And I think that's one of the things that sets this game apart for me is that, you know, narrative exploration games perhaps is one of the, I don't know if that's the genre phrase that you had heard.
Very, very elegant way to put it.
I think that they catch a lot of flack because they don't necessarily have anything besides you walk around to space and you experience a story. And I think what Remains of Edith Finch first sets it apart from a lot of the games like it in that it does, I don't know, the minimal mechanics are, they're definitely simple in all the death vignettes, but they matter and they're important and they immerse you. They ground you in, and they make you participate in these deaths, which I can't really remember the first time through when I realized, like, oh, every single one of these people is dead as I was playing.
Mm-hmm.
Like the second, I don't know, maybe it was the second or the third vignette, I immediately went, oh, all these people are dead. Every single one. And I'm good. That's what we're doing here. Do you remember having that reaction at any point?
Well, I feel like Edith says somewhere where she's walking up to the house that she's the last one alive. And so I want to say I kind of surmised, given the kind of spooky atmosphere to begin with, that this was going to be a story of loss. And, you know, maybe it involved people who had managed to escape or that there was more details to that. But I want to say I at least gleaned pretty quickly that this was, if she was the last one alive, then a lot of people probably had to die for a house that size.
Yeah, I mean, it's not necessarily that they were all dead. It's more like every single one of these vignettes is gonna kill someone. And I think that's more
that's
like...
That's fair, yeah. That's a different thing.
And I think that's... I don't know. I feel like I had a... I think that's another thing. I feel like this game executes really well. And something that I think is kind of vital for it to work at all is that as you are going back through this house, exploring it, and in each room or bedroom of her family members, you're taking part in their death. You're experiencing how they died in a lot of ways, you know, sometimes more obtuse than others. And the game is sad. I don't want to downplay that at all because it is incredibly sorrowful, but it never
wallows in it.
No, it never becomes maudlin. It never becomes like, oh, wow, look how sad this is. It seems to always, they balance like a certain kind of hopefulness, even amongst all of the tragedy.
Yeah, and they use the art to buoy it in some ways. Like what I really find interesting about the story and I would say the general theme of the entire video game is that they find that hopefulness less in the events themselves and more how the events are conveyed. And I mean, it works on multiple levels because you have obviously the people who are making this game deciding, hey, we want to tell these sad stories, but we want to tell them in this kind of hopeful way. But it also fits in universe where you have this kind of Finch spirit to each of these recollections, to each of these remembrances where some grisly thing has happened, but they treat them, they preserve them, they react to them in a way that finds the beauty in them, that finds the thing worth preserving about them and saving it for the next generation to find.
Do you think, and I think one of the questions the game asks is how worthwhile are these stories? I think that is in near the end of the game, it is the argument between Edith's mother and Edie, her great grandmother, is Edie Finch, who's Edith Finch, Edith's namesake, I think. Yeah, I got or the backwards.
Yes. Backwards. No, Edie is the
great grandmother.
Edie is the great grandmother who is the namesake of Edith.
Right.
She says at one point she used to be called Edith Jr.
And Dawn, Edith's mother, is arguing about how the fact Edie is the person who memorializes all these dead people, these dead family members. She is the one who insists on a grave, on a graveyard, a family graveyard. I assume is the one who commissions all those tombstones. Is the one who memorializes all of them in their own little in their rooms. And Edith's mother takes Edith away because she thinks the stories is what is killing the family.
I say it's a tough push and pull. And one of the good things about the game is it feels like it gives both of them a certain amount of equal time. It shows you Edie preserving these things and finding that beauty in them, that she comes up with these fantastical ways of conveying who her siblings and children and grandchildren were, and seems to have inspired something in each of them to hang on to these memories of their loved ones. But you also see people getting lost in them and making dangerous choices, in some cases deadly choices, because they get lost in these stories. And I think by the end of the game, Ian Dallas, the writer, and the rest of the creative team tip their hands with the credits that have, in memory of, I think Shirley Dallas is the name of his mother at the beginning of the end credits. It seems to suggest they side with the idea of preserving people through art, preserving people through these memorials that tell their stories. But they're also not immune to the idea that getting lost in those stories can be dangerous. And the same sense of adventure, the same sense of wonder that causes somebody to use their imagination and see these bigger, deeper worlds can also make them lose sight of the real world and lead them into difficult situations that they come to regret and that the people who love them come to regret.
And this game, I think, you are mired in, I don't want to say being lost, but I think mired in kind of in a maze, in a, like, the structure of the game itself is layer under over layer over layer of stories of you are theoretically Edith's son. I think it's a guy, I want to say.
Yes.
Reading her diary, that's the first layer. And then Edith herself is experiencing, every time she is reading letters or, entering into a vignette of one of her family members, that's another layer. And then often in those vignettes, you are delving another layer or another two layers deep through the whatever storytelling method they're using in that particular scene. In near the end there, you are reading Edith's journal, you are Edith reading a journal, then you are young, there's a flashback sequence where she herself is reading another story that was written by Edie, and that's five or six levels of obfuscation of unreliable narrator, blurring the meaning in there. And the house itself is a maze. It is full of secret doors, hidden tunnels, hidden keys, doors glued shut, acrobatic climbs across rooftops, which I would not, a pregnant 17-year-old girl probably shouldn't be doing, but whatever.
I'm no doctor, but I agree.
I pregnant, 20-week pregnant, any women that are 20 weeks pregnant, I don't know how, maybe controversial, don't think they should be climbing on rooftops on a third story building.
I think you're going out on a limb there, Robbie.
I thought we were friends.
I'll see myself out.
I thought we were friends. and I feel like that is, I feel like the hopeful tone of the game is necessary, because I think if it wasn't there, it would, the maze-like quality of everything, plus this kind of the dour, sad kind of messages in the vignettes you get, I think this game would be too sad. It would be too melancholic to participate in. I don't know if I could bear it, frankly. But I think that is also, like you say, that they tip their hand and that they think there is value in holding on to these stories and memorializing these people. And even I think that might be true, but I think there is a message in here about indulging in the fantasy and the, I'm trying to think of the right word, indulging in the, I don't
escapism?
Even, no, I would even say fetishizing death.
That's fair.
I think
I think that's certainly what Dawn fears that Edie has done, and that she may have instilled in her children and grandchildren and potentially great-grandchildren, that Dawn is worried about. And you can see it. You can see both the way that house is a mausoleum in some ways. It has these memorials to everyone in it, and you are constantly surrounded by the reminders of people who have died. And at the same time, it's also a celebration of their lives. I know that's kind of a trite thing to say, but she doesn't so much revel in their deaths as she tries to cushion it. All of these things, all of these stories turn these tragic events into something less painful than they might otherwise be.
Yeah,
there's downsides to that. It makes people less afraid of something that they should certainly be afraid of, but it also turns something terrible and something that is painful into something that can be appreciated and made easier to. That's the word I'm looking for, to
digest
and countenance.
I think that it is a. I don't want. I feel like I have. I there is a. A YouTube, it's not really a review, a YouTube video about this, about the game, and it's titled The Villain of What Remains of Edith Finch, and it is about Edie. It is about the great-grandmother and paints her as a villain, as a literally kind of a person that has gotten so lost in grief that she ends up dooming the rest of her family because she is so obsessed with death. And I don't necessarily I appreciate that. But I don't necessarily agree with it. I feel like that's the beauty of this, in that it is not necessarily, it is subtle enough in that it does not necessarily say, here is what we think, and here is death is this, and stories are these, and you shouldn't think otherwise. I feel like that's what makes Edie a real character to me, is that you start to understand as you play through these vignettes that she has been here for all of this. She has lived while everyone around her has died. She is the oldest, eldest Finch, and because she's survived, she's had to kind of cushion it, like you said. She's had to, or she wouldn't be able to take it, I would imagine.
She's lost somebody. From her father down to her great-grandchildren, and in some instances, many people. And that has to do something to a person. I mean, I never thought of Edie as a villain playing the game.
Right.
I don't think it's an unfair interpretation, but I also don't think she's culpable in some ways, or at least not malicious in anything.
No, I don't. I agree.
At some point, Edith is remarking in her journal that her mom, Dawn, came home after her husband Sanjay died. And so that Edie was happy about it, or was glad to have her. They had a lot in common. They had both lost a lot. And that's what's interesting about that push and pull between Edie and Dawn that takes place through so much of this game, is that they come from the same place. They're reacting to the same events, and yet they have diametrically opposed responses to it as to how it should be, how all these tragedies should be treated and responded to.
And I think that also that the piece painting her as a villain is also taking in a lot of the events in this game at face value. It is blaming a lot of the deaths on bad parenting, like Molly eats poisonous berries that are in her room, and it's irresponsible. Or Calvin, he's on a swing, and he flies off a cliffside because a swing is too close to the edge. And I don't feel like this game is meant for, you're not meant to necessarily take each event at face value. You're not supposed to believe that they were like, yeah, we'll have a swing on the side of a cliff, and so we can, so a kid can die, or like we're bad parents. Like
I would argue quite the contrary. I think every vignette is meant to be filtered through somebody's perspective and somebody's narration that makes it inherently unreliable, if only for the fact that you are, as you mentioned earlier, hearing somebody tell a story about somebody tell a story about somebody telling a story.
Yeah, and I think that blurring of what actually happened is intentional and purposeful, and is blunts and dulls what we perceive and what we can assume as true, but also shows us the as much as this game is about death, it is also about stories and how we tell them. And how inherently, there is no reliable narrator. That anyone telling a story, there are always facts that are mislaid. There's always perception, I don't know, inconsistencies in perception because we're people. Because we're bad at things.
There are always biases. There are always failures of memory. There are always things that color our view of the events we experience in our lives. And those necessarily color how we retell those events.
Right. And I feel like because this because the story told in this game is so personal and is told through so many layers, I don't necessarily – like. And I feel like the story of the of Gregory – I feel like that is the one that is explicitly telling us that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is literally like the letter of Sam, right? Sam.
Yes.
Sam's letter to Kay, who was his wife, who is Dawn's father, which is Edith's mother. Well, I'm literally looking. I'm looking at the family tree, trying to get all this out clearly. And
so Sam is Edith's grandfather.
Correct. And Sam is like that vignette is us in the perspective of Gregory, who is a 1-year-old baby who's in a bathtub, playing and enjoying life like babies do. It's like one of the like every single we're gonna dive into the vignettes. Like
no pun intended.
No pun intended. But I feel like they do a great job of distancing themselves from each other while each remaining kind of fantastical in presentation, while also I don't know. I don't have any children. And I've heard multiple people who have played this game, and I feel like the people who are parents are destroyed the most by this one, by Gregory.
Understandably.
Yeah. And I think that's the thing about it is that because it is Gregory is a little baby and he's playing with his toys. The music, it's symphonic. It swells. It's playful. It's like a circus. You know, the toys are jumping up and down. There's frogs and whales and bath toys. And they're all cute and it's all friendly and funny. And then he dies and he drowns. And we're Edith reading Sam's letter to Kay, Sam telling Kay, you can't blame yourself. I don't blame you for that. I know you blame yourself, but you shouldn't. And we don't see their perspective. We see Gregory's, which is, he's just a kid playing in a bathtub. And Sam kind of Sam's description is like Gregory saw things in a different way. He wasn't I don't know. I bounce back and forth between how supernatural this game is like how many of these things we're supposed to see as otherworldly. I think that's intentional. Like it is again another obfuscation of like the storytelling aspects of like, oh, of course they tell the story, you're gonna embellish things.
So Robbie, have you ever? I assume have you read Slaughterhouse-Five?
Yes. Yeah, Vonnegut.
So there's. This is the Kurt Vonnegut book, and for the people listening who haven't read it, it tells the story of somebody who has gotten, quote-unquote, unstuck in time. They experience events out of sequence. They have interludes where they've been abducted by aliens and are experiencing that, and everything jumps around in place in time. And I remember after reading that book, spending a lot of time trying to figure out whether in the universe of the book, this was something that had really happened. Had Billy Pilgrim, the main character, gotten unstuck in time, or was this some kind of mental break that he had had as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder from the experiences he's had that are detailed in the book, or at least hinted at in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually I feel like I landed on the idea that the answer is it's both, that in some ways it doesn't really matter whether or not in the world of the book these things really happened or this is just somebody who had a mental break. They stand for the same idea that the book uses that notion of being unstuck in time to process the idea of post-traumatic stress disorder, whether it's literally true or not. And I feel the same way about Edith Finch. I've spent a lot of time wondering what the truth of these vignettes is, whether Molly did turn into some kind of sea monster and got gobbled up by herself, or at least got to see some version of herself get gobbled up, or whether she was somebody who ate poisonous berries and toothpaste and then was lost in a hallucination in food poisoning. I think that the answer is it's both. It has to be both, that these are in some ways supernatural events that are meant to be literally true in the world of the game, but they're also meant to be reflections of the way that Edie has embellished these stories to make them more palatable. And that the people who made the game have embellished these stories to give us those experiences, like being Gregory in the bathtub, that help us to understand what that experience is, to impact us, to make this scene that you are watching both wonderful and delightful and amazing, and then at the same time just breathtakingly sad. It has to be all of it at once. It has to be the supernatural and the literal combining to make meaning at the same time, at least in my book.
Yeah, and I think I and at the end of the day have to have you have to kind of make peace with that obfuscation, with multiple perspectives. And I feel like that is what this genre of game does better than any other. It is a question of perspective. You know, and I think I've written about this in relation to another narrative exploration game or walking simulator, which came out last year as well, Tacoma, which is another game that explores multiple perspectives. But in most video games, your perspective is the character you're playing as. You know, your perspective is Lara Croft. Your perspective is Nathan Drake. Your perspective is Nico in Grand Theft Auto 4, your perspective, like whatever that character is, that's who you are. You're that PC is you. You're playing as this guy. Certain RPGs allow you to move, bend that around. You know, like in Mass Effect, your shepherd is one of many possible shepherds. You can be a renegade, or you can be a paragon. You can be good or bad, or somewhere in between. And you decide how they look and what they do. But there's a limited range of perspective. You're always the hero, you're always that player character. And this game, and others like it, I think, challenge that notion of video games. It challenges the notion of this is your perspective, and it is true. It is unaltered truth. You know, what you're seeing is happening in this world of this game. And there's various games that do challenge that in a lot of ways. The BioShock games do that. System Shock before that. A lot of immersive sims, frankly, it is kind of the hallmark of that genre as well. And I feel like immersive sims and walking simulators are actually very close together. Immersive sims just have shooting along with along with the walking. You get guns. I think that's the difference. But
I'd say even Braid does that to an extent.
yeah, I mean, it is not a exclusive, but I feel like it's definitely more unconventional for it to be played with in other genres. You know, when you're playing Super Mario, when Mario jumps on a Goomba, you're not taken to like a vignette of that Goomba's death and wondering like, and then questioning, is this really happening? Whereas Mario in some kind of fugue state, because he inhaled plumbing chem chemicals or something.
Maybe you don't wonder that.
I'm too busy killing Goombas, man. Born to die, that's the Goomba's motto.
It's harsh. It's harsh, man.
It is harsh, but that's their life. But this game, I feel like it plays with that question of perception, of perspective, of who are you playing as? All right, what are you seeing? Is what you're seeing true? Is that meaningful? Does the truth matter? Like, and I, like all those questions, I feel like are all layered on top of the story itself. I want to talk about these vignettes. I want to talk about.
Let's do it.
I want to. I like. They are so good. There's, and that's another thing. Like the question perspective. You're. You. Let's see. There's Molly. there's Barbara, there's Walter, there's Calvin, Sam, Gus, Gregory, Lewis. I think that's all of them you directly experience.
You do Milton? I guess we don't directly experience.
Yeah, there's Milton and Milton. There's, of course, Odin. We don't experience. Sven, we don't experience. Milton, we don't experience. Sanjay, Dawn, we don't experience. And Edith, we don't experience her death, which is assumed she is dead.
I mean, we kind of do, depending on how you want to interpret the ending.
I guess that's true. I don't know. I don't know about that. But all those people, we experience their story. The story of how they die. We've already touched Molly, which is poison. She eats poisoned berries and toothpaste and an old nasty carrot, which is it? The carrot is the thing that bothers me the most. It's not the
Why the carrot?
I don't know. It's sitting in a hamster cage. It's old. Oh, it seems really gross. Like a berry doesn't. I know the berry's actually poison, but.
I was going to say the berry's the thing that probably does it.
I know, but it's. The actual taste of the... I can't imagine that carrot is good. But
I can't imagine the berries great either.
Berries taste good, like strawberries.
Well, some berries,
blueberries,
but not,
blackberries, they're delicious.
I don't imagine like a berry that's sitting on holly is going to be particularly flavorful, or at least not good flavorful.
Oh, she's very hungry. But we see her... hers is a story of transformation, of her becoming a cat eating a bird. And then she's a shark? No.
Yes, that's correct.
She's the shark, and no, she's the cat. Then she's an owl. Then the shark.
That's correct.
Then the sea monster.
Well, that part's so important because it's your first vignette, and it lets the player know that they're in for surprises. That like you walk out the window, and it's the first time something explicitly supernatural or different than just exploring this house happens, and I think it puts the player on notice of what kind of game this is going to be.
Yeah. And also, yeah, I remember my exact reaction when I was a shark. I'm like, what's like, I'm like, okay, I'm a cat. I get it. And then suddenly I'm a shark tumbling down a mountainside. I'm like, Whoa. And then
it's a very surreal image.
And then I'm a sea monster eating people on a boat, which, all right. Okay. Got it. I don't know. Molly's is a one of introduction, and I feel like the transformation element of it is kind of cluing you in, like you're going to change, not just in this whole game is you shifting what you are. You are going to be different things and different people.
And I think the sea monster thing really gets at that because. To what we were talking about earlier, it uses the mechanics. Like, you move differently as the sea monster than you move as anything else in the game, and it conveys the alienness of it. It conveys that it is something different and you are something different. And What Remains of Edith Finch uses every tool in its toolbox to try to get you to feel and be something different as you're playing the game.
Yeah, and in the vignettes, I think, go to lengths to separate themselves from each other, because the next one is Barbara's, which it is told in the style of a comic book. It is a Tales from the Crypt EC Comics, like the voice of the Crypt Keeper is the narrator, like it is not, and they use the theme from Halloween.
Did they get clearances for that? They had to, like, it's so close. I don't think it falls into fair use territory.
I don't know. I have no idea. The composer is a film composer, or soundtracks to Fargo TV series, and The Night Of and Power, which I don't know what those are, but Jeff Russo.
The Night Of is a HBO show.
Oh, okay. He was also in Tonic.
Don't know Tonic.
The band Tonic, rock band.
I'm not familiar with it.
Let me think. What's one of their songs that you would know? 90s. It was 90s.
Is this going to be like the time I found out that Danny Elfman and Jack Skellington was from Oingo Boingo?
Oh, If You Could Only See. That's the okay, that's the song. That's the Tonic song that everyone... If you could only see... that's my really good Tonic. But that's Jeff Russo is from Tonic, and he also is a composer.
Gotcha.
But he... Oh, well, you know what else he composed, Andrew?
What did he compose?
Star Trek Discovery.
Oh, all right. So we've got some podcast synergy going on here.
He also did Altered Carbon as well, which I've not watched yet, but in Legion as well. So a lot of modern television.
Heard good things about a lot of those.
Yeah. But you're reading about Barbara's death. Barbara is a child actress, and struggling for fame now that she is a teenager. And you're reading about her, and like, this is, when you really think about it, kind of like the most morbid one, because it is like a comic book is made about her death after the fact, basically. And it's like a true crime comic, but told through like EC Comics style, almost.
But it doesn't feel morbid because it's so exaggerating. I mean, you have the Crypt Keeper-esque puns, you have this sort of silly narrative about getting the right scream out of her. It all feels too cartoony to feel like it's gauche in some way. And it's only when you stop and think about it, you're like, oh yeah, hey, she probably wasn't attacked by Halloween monsters. She was probably murdered by her boyfriend or some serial killer or something along those lines that gives you the tragedy.
Yeah.
I feel like that's a trick that the game pulls constantly.
It is.
You experience this wonderful story and it's told in a particular way and it's engaging. And then you sort of get 5 minutes away from it and stop and realize like, oh right, that's terrible. It's a horrible thing that happened to this person.
Yeah. I think it is kind of, and I feel like it is not, and normally I think I would be dulled to that trick because it is when they pull multiple times. Like it is multiple times that you are playing through these vignettes and you're like remembering it afterwards. Like, oh right. Yeah. Her boyfriend probably killed her. At least that's what the police think, because he disappeared after her death. But it is not necessarily the same trick, I think. I think, like, it is... because each of them play with the genre conventions in a lot of ways, which is, like, this is the first clue to me, like, that the game is, like, it is knowledgeable about story. It is knowledgeable about story tropes and storytelling, and, like, every step along the way, it is subverting those tropes in a lot of ways, or embellishing them, like in the case of Barbara, because you said, like, the puns, my God, the Crypt Keeper puns, and like the Halloween, like the theme from Halloween, and the idea of monsters, like they are aware of these tropes and use them in the embellishment of Edie's embellishment of all these deaths. It seems Edie herself is using those tropes of, she's not, the game is knowledgeable about them, and the way they tell these stories are knowledgeable.
And each one's a little different, which helps make the tricks less noticeable in that way.
Yes, exactly. And they're not necessarily, I don't know. I feel like, even when I recognize them, I don't begrudge them. I don't ever go, oh, I don't know. It feels oftentimes, you know, I read or see or play something and I can recognize immediately, oh, that's, I can see what you're doing. You're moving me over here so you can pull this trick over here. I know what storytelling shenanigans you're getting up to. It's not going to work on me. You got to be smarter. You got to be better than that. And in this case, I don't know, like I think looking back, I recognize it, but when every time I play through it, I don't think about it. I think that's part of it, because it is a video game. I'm immersed.
Well, at the same time, it never feels like the game is trying to manipulate you. Like it feels like it's trying to use these storytelling tropes to explain how its characters are processing these things, or to create this veil between you and what really happened, but it serves the game's ends and it serves the story that's being told, rather than it feeling like the people in the game are trying to trick you. I mean, we say the word trick, but it doesn't feel like at the end of Barbara's story, Ian Dallas or somebody is going, gotcha. It's more just the way that they convey their theme. And I think that's what the difference is to me.
And I think after, what is it, after Barbara, there is Walter? Is Walter next?
I believe that's right.
Who is...
No, wait, no, it's
Calvin?
Calvin next.
Calvin yeah. next? Okay. Yes, Calvin.
With the swing.
Yeah, and then Walter, right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. And Calvin, yeah, Calvin is, I don't know, he is...
No, wait, do we get Calvin before we get Barbara? I think we get... Am I mixed up?
I don't even... I could be wrong. I'm not... Okay, these are not in any explicit correct order. I am just trying to keep them in some semblance of sense. But Walter...
For clarity, I think we get Molly and then Calvin and then Barbara and then Walter.
Okay. Well, Calvin and... Like, those... I think those first three of Molly, Calvin, and Barbara are all... They are all children. They're all... Barbara's a teenager, but she's still, you know, not an adult. But Molly is 10. Calvin is younger than 10, I think. I think he's like 8 or something. He's swinging, and he swings, falls off a cliff, as far as I can tell. And the only, like, his, I think, is probably the simplest one to me. You know, the simplest little vignette. All you're doing is swinging back and forth. And Calvin wanted to be an astronaut?
He certainly has lots of space stuff all around
right.
his room.
They mentioned him wanting to fly, and him he wanted the swing to go all the way around, and doesn't quite make it. I feel like Calvin's was probably the least impactful on me, although it's a very enjoyable like vignette. Enjoyable. I say that a lot. Like these are all like a lot of them are actually fun. Like they're like. Calvin's is fun and Gregory's is fun to like actually to fun to play. Like you're like Calvin, you're swinging. Like that's a like swings are fun. Having you're embodying this little child who's so happy to be swinging and he just wants to get over. He wants to go the full 360.
I was like, Calvin's was the one I think made me laugh the most. Though that may just be the line. My brother said he'd die before and eat another mushroom. And sure enough, he did. Like, there's some real gallows humor to that really tickled me, I have to admit.
Well, I think that the game's not ashamed of that, of its gallows humor, because I would imagine any family that has that many deaths would have to indulge in it occasionally, or they'd go crazy, probably. But he definitely did. He died before he ate another mushroom. I think, did he also have a... broken leg while he was on the swing?
I don't recall. Maybe.
I can't remember either. I remember, like, and that's another hallmark of the, like, the game is constantly throwing you things of, like, all these people are incredibly incredibly risky. Like, they are clumsy or, like, I mean, you have Edith climbing on the roof while she's 20 plus weeks pregnant. You have the people, like, are constantly, I don't know, taking risks that are probably I feel like maybe they're also exaggerated because we are put in this position of playing through the game where there's so many deaths and you're like, oh right, that's really, and like you said at the very beginning of the podcast, it makes you think about doing simple things and how deadly they could be, and that frame of mind changes things.
I'm certainly not going to go swinging over any cliffs anytime soon.
I was going to do it tomorrow, but I changed plans. So Calvin falls, and then Walter, which Walter's a really unique case because him and Sam are the only adults.
And Edie. And Dawn.
No, but we don't experience them.
Oh, that's fair. That's fair.
I mean, him and Sam, and even Sam, we don't. Like, Sam we experience through Dawn. We're not Sam in his vignette. We are
briefly. Very briefly.
Oh, right. Well, we're the camera.
Yeah.
Technically. But Walter is the one that we are Walter. You know, we are Walter who is living in a bunker out of fear. Who's eats the same food every day.
And I think... Walter is meant in some ways to be the the extreme that Edie is worried about with Dawn, that Dawn is worried about this curse and worried about that sort of sense of imagination and adventure, that you close yourself off from the world and you stop having these experiences. I think Walter is perhaps something that helps inform how Edie feels about all these stories and all these terrible adventures, because she says, what is the alternative? The alternative is you become Walter and you don't know how to leave your bunker that you make for yourself.
Yeah, and it is Walter's is, I feel like, one that is not, it is the least fantastical. It is like all the other ones are more adventurous or have more air of fantasy around them. Walter's is hanging out in a bunker for how many years?
At least 30, right? It's like he goes from the 60s to 2005, I want to say.
Eating the same canned peaches every day. That's a lot of peaches, man.
Peaches come from a can.
They were put there by a man in a factory downtown. Millions of them. I don't I think Walter is that so he is it is sobering. And I feel like it is that variance of, we see Molly changing into different animals. We have Calvin flying through off of a swing. We have Barbara adult, like living through an EC Comics. And then we have Walter's very kind of staid experience of living underground with his walls shaking at the same times every day. And which, and talking about the tricks the game pulls, those walls shaking every day, it never, I was like, what? Is this really happening? Is like, are we in his head or something? Like, I was really confused, like, about the shaking. I'm like, what is going on? Why is everything shaking?
When he talks about a monster, and so my first thought was, oh, it's the same sea monster from Molly's story that is like rushing underneath the house or something.
Yeah, and like, I don't remember if they show you train tracks before that at any point.
I don't believe they do.
When is at what? I'm trying to remember at what point in the sequence does Edith go out into the graveyard?
It's immediately after Walter's story.
Right. That's okay. So, and Walter is so Walter is that kind of the counterpoint to Edie. It is Dawn's, I don't know, belief that these stories are killing the family and that we are perpetuating our own circle of death, and if we all we have to do is forget the past, move on, be careful, and we'll be able to get past our history. And Walter is the counterpoint of like, how careful can you be? And like, it's almost like Walter's is almost like a punchline to me. You talk about the gallows humor. Walter's is like, he's like talking about, yeah, I bit he, you live through all those 30 years of him eating peaches every day and the change in music on the radio. And then he finally leaves and immediately gets hit by a train, which you realize is what has been shaking the walls.
So I played this game for a second time with my wife, and as soon as that happened, her first response was she started singing "Ironic" by Alanis Morissette.
Yes, which the irony that song is called Ironic because nothing inside of it is actually irony.
That is the ultimate irony.
The
Again,
ultimate.
it's like Edith Finch, it's layers upon layers upon layers.
It's like rain. I don't know. I appreciate what Walter does thematically, and I like the fact that he is like the aged of all the vignettes we experience. Everyone else is relatively young. They're young, tragic deaths. Walter's is, I think, tragic not because he's young, but because he's old, because he hasn't experienced much in all those years.
Because he didn't get to live his life.
Yeah, he lived in a bunker eating peaches every day. Ain't no way to live.
And when there is that beautiful moment when he emerges just before he hits the train, and he said, like, even if I only got a year, even if I only had a week, even if I only had one good day, and he looks up at the sky and he sees the sun for the first time in 30 years, and you feel it with him. I keep saying this so often, but it puts you in his shoes and gives you that, and in 3 minutes, gives you the experience of what what it would be like to see the sun for the first time in 30 years after being afraid and being tired of being afraid, in a way that getting hit by a train is funny and sad, but also kind of beautiful in its way. Like, I'm going to go out on a bit of a limb here, but I think part of the intention is to say that it was worth it. That one beautiful moment of freedom is, I don't know.
Better than
dying that way is better than living another 10 years and dying in that bunker.
Probably. Yeah, I agree with you there. Then we get I think the house is an important part of all this, obviously, of Edith exploring the house and looking at all those, how each room is much part of these vignettes as the vignettes themselves, because they all are giving little bits of background information. They are kind of coloring our perception about what and who these people were. You know, we see Calvin and Sam's room as children. We see Molly's room. We see Barbara's room. We see that incredible experience of opening that door of was it Walter's room with the ocean on the walls?
Yes, that is Walter's room.
That is when I first looked into that room. When that door, the first time you open that door and you look into that room, I wasn't sure if I was going to be walking into an ocean. Like, I didn't know what the, like, because this game is constantly challenging you with different experiences of, like, anytime you touch anything, I wasn't sure, like, I was going to walk into that room, I would thought I was going to be underwater. And it's not quite off, because Walter was below.
He was. Well, I think it's a good opportunity to talk about the design in the game, because the house gives you this great sense of place. Like, each room does tell you about who the characters are, and the house itself feels like a corporeal metaphor for all these stories being built on top of each other until they become lopsided and kind of ugly, but also part of this same almost living, breathing thing that exists out on the coast in the middle of all this forest.
It is another base. It is the Uber vignette. It is the Uber setting for all of this. It is the umbrella that tells you, like, at first glance, you, like, as you're walking up to the house as Edith, you see this silhouette of this monstrosity of this, you know, and it is Burton-esque in its design. And I mean that in the best way possible, because I feel like this game tells a better story using the same, in a lot of ways, the same genre conventions that Tim Burton uses, but does it in a much better way. And I think that house, full of secret compartments and hidden mysteries, and I don't know, it is all metaphor. It is all symbol of Edith having to not only do mental gymnastics to piece together her family's history, but also literal physical gymnastics. She has to literally crawl through corridors and find hidden keys. It is a dungeon in a lot of ways. It feels like Zelda.
And it makes it more of a tactile experience. Like, you hear her breathing, you feel her squeezing into passages, you see her climbing. It gives it a sense of place. It gives it a sense of you being there, as opposed to just moving weightlessly through this world.
When did you realize she was pregnant?
So I did not realize she was pregnant until she said as much. I think I looked down and thought it looked kind of weird, but assumed that was just sort of a strange wrinkle of first-person perspective. My wife got it literally within 3 minutes of starting the game. Like, looked down and went, oh, she's pregnant, is she? And I was like, I don't know, keep playing. In my head, I'm like, damn it, why are you smarter than me?
I didn't realize I am the middle. I'm in between. I realized at a certain point I saw her. I looked down and I was like, all right, yeah, she has a bit of a tummy. I wonder if she's actually pregnant or not. And then there is a bit before she says she's pregnant, when she says it's tough squeezing in through here with my tummy. And I'm like, oh yeah, she's definitely pregnant. And that makes perfect sense in the context of the game.
I'd say it's the only real, like, reveal in the game, for lack of a better term.
Yeah, and it then it immediately, I think, like, there are a lot of, like, yeah, the each vignette has its own kind of, like, sense of, like, oh, that's what's happening here. But it, there's no, like, big, I think it's frankly for the game's benefit that there isn't, like, the mystery isn't really just one, there isn't one big thing that Edith discovers and suddenly everything is unraveled. It is more assemblage, like you said, the house and of this weird leaning top heavy, wobbly, ugly construction of stories. And I think that's more honest in most ways about most families, even, like, when it's not like, yeah, that they have this curse on their house, but it's not that simple. It's not just, oh, they're cursed.
And also, I guess the other big reveal is Edith's fate, you know, what happens to her. But that feels more like the last story you're being told as part of, like, the capstone to what's happening with the house itself, as opposed to a twist in some way.
Well, I don't, it's only a twist is because maybe you forget about how the game begins, but you're like, you don't start the, you start the game reading a journal that is Edith's. And I don't know. I was at the moment, I kind of half realized when I realized she was pregnant, I'm like, we're not, whoever's reading this journal is not Edith. And I didn't assume she was dead, but it, the way the story went, it, more and more, I just, at the end, it was more, it wasn't really a sudden reveal that, oh, she died as well. It was more of kind of a building kind of sadness in me as they went. I'm like, Edith didn't make it either. She didn't get out of this.
Well, so I may just be slow because, again, I didn't pick up on the pregnancy thing. And I initially assumed that the opening scene on that boat was Edith leaving her family home and, like, looking back on her experience or, like, remembering her experience. It wasn't until the end that I realized it was her son.
Well, I think that's what they want you to believe at the beginning.
Is it? Okay.
I think they want it to be a question of what's going on. And it's not necessarily like it was, like, I was amazing, the Kreskin or something, but it was more, I connected the dots. I did not need them to tell me that Edith is dead. I don't think that necessarily the game wants you to believe that one way or the other. I think the game is strong enough that it doesn't necessarily spell things out. I think it hints at things. It, most things in this game are hinted at once or twice or three times before it ever tells you anything. Like, each of those, every time, like, every single member of the family, you have hints about what happened to them long before we are told. Like, Sven, you see the remnants of that dragon as you walk up to the house, hidden in a swamp, you know, buried in a muck.
You see the missing posters for Milton. You see the can stacked up in their kitchen before you see what happens to Lewis. Like, yeah, there's a lot of, I guess that was what was really interesting playing the game a second time, was seeing all those bits of foreshadowing, all those hints that they install in various places before you actually see what the buildup is. I mean, even just seeing that deer cross your path at the very beginning of the game, much like it does at the end of the game,
yeah,
struck me on the second go around.
Yes. And like, this game is worth playing through multiple times. It's like watching and I don't want to necessarily compare it to like watching a good movie, because I feel like that does a disservice to it, but it is, you experience, like, certain games, I think you can't just play once and you get everything you need out of it. I think every time I'm going to be playing this game every year for the rest of my life, because I feel like because it is only a few hours, because it has that depth of exploration of information, of you'll see more and more every time you play. And even though the game doesn't change, you do. Going back to the graveyard sequence also has those clues in it on each of the tombstones. And
each of the tombstones reflects how the person passed away, I want to say, or, like, I guess, yeah, something essential about their character.
Yeah, every single tombstone has a something on it, even the ones you haven't gone through yet. All, even, let's see, Gus, Gregory, Lewis, and Milton doesn't have Milton has a tombstone, but he does not have a death date on it.
Yeah, he has a memorial.
Yeah, he has.
Dawn was very clear about that.
Yes, exactly. And Lewis has a crown on his, which you don't get that. You don't understand what that means at all until, you know, an hour later in the game. But that sequence is what really clicked in. I remember distinctly the first time I was playing the game and walking through that graveyard and looking and seeing, I think it is Odin's tombstone.
Or his memorial with him on top of the house.
Yes. Yeah. And that kind of cemented in my mind what was happening and what it, like, at that point in the game, I didn't know what I was doing really. And I'm just kind of wandering and I'm like, this is what is going on with this family. And then I see they have a graveyard, a family graveyard on a cliffside, which makes I think that all those, you talk about design and craft, like that graveyard, I think, is the perfect symbol for what the game is like in general. It is a ridiculous memorial that makes no sense.
What kind of family builds a graveyard before they build their house?
Right. And you see Odin, who is he doesn't finish the trip. He drowns in the ocean before they land. He goes down with his house. And yet he is the one that is like, he is this, like, it's triumphant. He's standing on top of this house. He's like boldly staring out into the ocean. And immediately I went, I get it. This family is, this is what they're fighting. They're fighting against death. They're fighting against this curse. And the only way Edie, and I guess, I mean, by extension, the rest of the family can deal with it is by treating it like, can treat dying as heroism, to boldly go into death, you know, speaking of Star Trek.
To not be afraid of it.
Yeah.
To look at these things and process them as triumphant stories rather than as terrible tragedies.
And they have to survive. I mean, like, they're fighting off death like that, even though, but is that good? We don't know. Like, it is a really well-crafted scene because it is one that, like, it's nighttime, the moon is shining, and I think you can see at this point, I don't know if you can you see the house out there?
Yeah, there's a little telescope that you look through can make it out.
You can see the old house, the one that made the trip but didn't finish it. And I feel like it is a good thematic, like, halfway point. I feel like it is like, here, you have visited the graveyard and now it is, you're halfway through this journey and now you have to finish it.
Well, and even just, you know, I know we didn't touch on Odin's story that much, but you see that house sunk off the coast there, and it feels like the tension that is inherent to the story is symbolized in that one image, or at least that one tale of Odin. He left Norway because he wanted to escape this family curse, but he brought his house with him. The house from which these bricks, you know, its bricks were used to build the chimney in the new house. It speaks to that same sense of people trying to get away, but being unable to let go of the past at the same time. Like that, it has Edie's desire to embrace what came before and Dawn's desire to move on without thinking about it, or at least not being bound by what happened in the past.
Yeah, it is a question of, to survive, I need to cut off my legacy, but without my legacy, what am I? I am nothing without my name. My name is me. How can I continue without it? But yet I need to. You know, there is that, and you know, that ties into the idea of family as a whole, of idea of Edith's struggles of coming back to discover what was gone, and yet that very fact is that good? Should she have come back at all? Hard to say.
It's at least an open question.
And then we get the latter half of the vignettes, which are, is Sam the next one, or does it go straight to his kids.
I believe Sam is next.
Well, I mean, I guess his is a measure of his children, right? Because his children include Dawn, which is how he dies on a hunting trip with Dawn, which is we see through a camera, which like works. This is not my favorite of the vignettes, but I really marvel at how well it's constructed, both in its structurally and in its execution about how Sam is a hunter and he wants to take Dawn hunting with him. Dawn has a camera and she wants to shoot pictures and he wants to shoot animals.
Isn't Sam a big photographer too? Isn't that part of it? Because he gave old cameras to various kids.
I don't remember that.
I think that's true, but I could be getting various Finches mixed up.
I'm not saying you're wrong. I just don't. There's a lot of different background information. I don't know. I always find that fascinating. Like that, it's not like this is the first thing that's done that kind of, we're going hunting and. Well, hunting is more than just looking at animals. Hunting is killing animals at the end of the day. And Sam ends up dying because he forces Dawn to shoot a deer and then wants a picture with it. And he is kicked off a cliffside by the dying deer. And
it's the saddest version of Pokemon Snap I've ever played.
Pokemon Snap was a good game. I wish they
very good game.
I wish they'd make a they should make more photography games. I feel like that is I want a game that has no guns. You just have a camera but has the same kind of scope as the big games that you shoot things with. Instead, it's all about how
no good. No pun intended.
Yes, exactly. And I don't know. It feels like it really captures both Sam and Dawn's character very well. And also, again, brings up the question of perspective. Because what our perspective in this, and this is the one where the one case where I feel like it is actually relatively concrete, at least what we see in those pictures.
But it's very fitting because both Dawn and Sam, you get the impression, are the people who were least interested in these stories. Like Sam enlisted in the army as soon as he could. He wanted to get away. He saw what happened to his siblings and didn't want to be a part of it. And Dawn is the one who is constantly pushing back on Edie, trying to lock up these rooms and shut down these stories. And so it makes sense that the vision we get of the two of them is the least fantastical and the most concrete in some way.
And Dawn herself leaves as well. She goes off on the
Peace Corps, I think.
Peace Corps, yeah, exactly. That's where she meets Sanjay. I don't know. And it is Edith's first, she herself says, "My mother never told me this." And that it kind of gives us a peek into Dawn's and Edith's relationship about how, Edith doesn't know any of this because Dawn has not told her. Dawn has purposely cut her off from these stories. She doesn't want her to know any of it because she feels like it will kill her. Let's see. Then it's Gus and Gregory, right? Gus is the... Gus is the storm.
Yes. Gregory, then Gus.
Gregory, then Gus. So, Gregory, we've already touched on to a certain extent, the baby, which is heartbreaking, and Gus, which is also very a fun of these, because you're flying a kite, it's very childish and this Calvin swinging. Gus is like flying a kite, and as you're doing this, the story that we're reading is being is up on the sky and you're demolishing these letters with your kite.
And there's a wry tone to the poetry. Like, again, as with Calvin, some of the lines are pretty darn funny.
Yes. It reminded me of Winnie the Pooh.
I can see it.
And the blustery, and the
kites and rhyming.
Yeah. And the blustery day, which is also I think tonally it also reminded me. It's not just the aesthetically of the wind blowing away letters. It's also tonally like Winnie the Pooh is a childish story, but actually subtly terrifying at times. And Gus ends up getting electrocuted because he's flying a kite during his father's second wedding ceremony.
Is he electrocuted, or does the storm I guess I got the impression that like the tent was caught up in the storm and collided into him, and that was what
Oh,
killed
I
him.
mean, maybe. I don't think it tells. I just like lightning is very pow I mean, it's calamitous storm. Whatever floats your boat.
Or
Whatever.
since it is the case, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, it is another aspect of Gus of family being a root cause of a lot of things of us. It like it serves as a reminder of the family, of tumultuous change in this family, and it directly leads to a death. And then we get to Edith's generation, Edith's brothers, and Lewis is before Milton, or is Milton before
No, I'm
Lewis?
pretty sure Milton precedes Lewis. I think
Right.
Lewis is the
Right.
last one before the finale, so to speak.
Yeah, and Milton is just vanishes. He's just gone.
So this was the one that confused me the most, I had to admit. Like even some of the more fantastical ones, I felt like there was a pretty clear idea as to maybe what really happened. This was the one where it wasn't clear whether he like leapt out the window or ran away or hid. What the story was exactly. I did a little bit of reading about it, and apparently the game's writer, there was a previous game made by the same writer in the same studio called The Unfinished Swan,
Correct.
and he has suggested that Milton escaped into the world of that game somehow.
Yes. I mean, yeah, that is, I feel like that is, it's not in the game. It's not in Edith Finch at all, but it is the, I mean, by Ian Dallas's Reddit interview, like the is he explicitly says, yes, that is where Milton went. Milton went into a painting and is in this other world. But I think that is fine. I think I like it without that explanation.
I agree. I think it works better as a mystery.
Yeah, and I think that I think it contributes to the unreliableness of all of these stories because it is finally one, it is kind of a death that Edie can't embellish. There's no story here because Milton is just gone.
In some ways, a death is better than somebody just being missing, because with the death, you have finality. But with a missing person, you just don't know. You don't know what happened, and in some ways, that eats at you more.
And I also read that as you explore the house, as you go through these little nooks and crannies, these hidden passages, you see Milton's drawings everywhere because he's an artist. And I think it is also like if you want an in-game explanation of what actually happened to him, he died in the bowels of the house somewhere exploring, got trapped.
It's a pretty unpleasant end.
Yeah, it's not great. And I mean, most of these aren't actually pleasant ends. When like we
Fair.
said, it's pretty grisly. But I mean, Milton is that's what because they never find his body, they don't know where he is. It is a, I feel like actually because there's no way for them to actually for Edie to like fetishize his death, it is again another like it is the like one of the most sobering deaths because there is no fantastical story. There's it's just he's gone. Never found him. And there's nothing we can do. There's only a memorial and he's not there's no death date on there. And there never will be.
There's no finality to it.
Yeah. And kind of it's not the last vignette really because th there is a kind of finale that is a sort of vignette in itself. But the last one that is a direct death, and that is Lewis. And this is the one that kind of tore me apart.
It is, for me, like the apotheosis of the game, of it combining theme and story and mechanics to put you in the head of the character you're inhabiting, but also just sort of rip your heart out of your chest.
And it's like, I think maybe if I had a kid, Gregory would affect me more, and I can understand why. But Lewis, like, I was Lewis. Literally, I had a job. I took a job. It was working in my dad's warehouse in the construction industry in Florida, aluminum construction, and they got some I was unemployed and I was looking for work, and they had a 2 days work for me, and I took it because I wanted some money. And it was literally like they had gotten some roofing panels in, for cheap, I think, but they had layers of plastic on them. They had plastic wrap on them, basically, and they couldn't be used that way. But it would take hours to remove it all. And they're not going to pay roofing crews, roofing crew money, to rip off plastic. They're going to pay roofing crews to install roofs. So I got paid for 2 days to rip off plastic off roofing panels. And that is what I did for 2 days straight. Two 10-hour days. All I did was stand in one place, roof panel in front of me, rip off plastic, rip off plastic, rip off plastic, move the panel, another panel, rip off plastic. And just that for 2 days straight. And I think a lot of people have had repetitive jobs. And when you have a job like that, your mind wanders. You go somewhere else because you don't want to be where you're at.
And the mind needs stimulation. There's nothing that is going to keep your mind fed in that. And so it's going to have to go try to feed itself somewhere else, even if it's a place that it has to invent.
Right. And Lewis is like, again, just so well crafted and constructed, because it is in this case it is a letter from his psychiatrist, which immediately, like, that in itself tells you something about Lewis. You're like, okay. And you enter his room, Lewis's room, and it has like marijuana leaves in like posters, and like it, like, so okay, he has used drugs and he's seeing a psychiatrist, and the letters from the psychiatrist paint this picture of like Lewis is going into this fantasy world, and all the while you are Lewis and you're in this mind-numbing job of cutting fish's heads off. And like you said, I've never seen anything like this in a game before. And that's why, and like this one sequence just like it immediately justifies, like, and it immediately refutes the argument about how these types of games aren't games, because there's nothing. I can't watch a movie and have this experience.
It is so integral to how you play it that the story is told, that you have the, you know, using one hand to grab the fish and move it out of the way, and the other hand to transverse this fantasy world to give you that sense of the repetitiveness. At the same time, it is giving you the sense of escapism. Could you do something like that in film? I think you certainly could, but it would not be as immersive as this is or feels.
I mean, yes, you're like, because you are control, because at the same time you are doing a repetitive, mind-numbing job cutting fish's heads off, at the same time you are transversing this fantasy world, but also making choices in this fantasy world. You know, you decide, is Lewis's character going after a prince or a princess? Is Lewis's character going to fight a dragon, or is he going to go build a kingdom? Is Lewis's character going to go this or this? And in like, it is taking an active role in creating this fantasy world. It's very simple choices, but they're there. And it is so simple. I think the simplicity belies what the game is doing to you. In that it is putting you so directly in Lewis's shoes of this kid trapped in this dead end job and wanting to chase after this fantasy world and end up getting lost in it.
And it has that fantasy world start out very simple and top down and gradually get more complex and take up more of the screen to help communicate to the player like how much more this fantasy is becoming Lewis's world. It's not just there. It's not just this separate thing. It's this growing, almost living organism that becomes his whole life. And it's not in one fell swoop. It's a gradual progression from one point to another.
Yeah. And it's also like I think there's very few games that I think can have adequately explored mental illness. Because it is an intrinsically incredibly hard thing to portray in a video game without being like inaccurate or crass or offensive, frankly. It is really hard to do. And I would have said, like, I another game that came out last year, Hellblade: Senua's Sacrifice, I think is the only other, like, there's a handful of games under probably one hand, less than five games that have able to like adequately convey mental illness and how it makes the afflicted feel, makes the person playing the game empathize and sympathize. And this is another portrayal of it, of you start to understand, like, Lewis is, it's not all at once. It's not sexy. It's not like, oh, one day he went crazy. It's, no, he's been fighting this for a long time, and it just eventually becomes too much.
And it's exacerbated, like it is for so many of the Finches, by losing somebody that he loves.
Yeah. Everything that, like, the trauma of death is ever present. It is not like these vignettes are like, because they are spaced out, because there's space between them, and that between every single one, you are Edith exploring this house and understanding and constantly seeing the signs of every other family member that died. That trauma is always there. And I think they even go to, like, you see it. You see the effects of that trauma in every generation. Like, Walter secludes himself because of it after the death of his brothers and sisters. Dawn leaves, and Lewis kills himself. And
it's a fun game.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm being glib, but it's exactly what we were talking about. Like, you do these things, and they're interesting, and they're very well done, and then you stop and reflect on them and go, my God, what these people have suffered.
And I think that is part of the magic of this game, is that all too often people will try and communicate the effects of death in art, and it is often too grim, or too, like, they communicate, like, there's nuance in sadness. There is nuance in tragedy. There is nuance in trauma. There is moments of everyone has gone to a funeral of someone close to them, have gone to a memorial service, and they laugh at something. They laugh during the service because someone tells a joke on purpose to, like, to lighten the mood, or in the service afterwards, you laugh. It's not, you don't, trauma is not, and death is not just sadness. It is a lot of things all at once. And that this game communicates that nuance in ways that a lot of art has failed to do so.
Agreed. It embraces all sides of death. It's not just a mournful march, and it's not a sort of gallows humor filled escapade where death is costless. It's all sides of it. It's the joy, it's the humor, it's the sadness, it's the acceptance. It's omnipresent, but always just outside the frame.
And it takes that and then ties it into it ties it into this family of real characters. I didn't feel like this was just a scholarly exploration of themes and metaphor. I felt things about all these characters. They felt like real people to me. They felt like I knew the Finches by the time I finished this game. And, like, considering that there are, like, 15 people in this family, that's, I think, quite a feat that is able to communicate all that in 2 or 3 hours. It ties in the themes of storytelling and perspective, ties in the themes of caution and fear and adventure, and it ties in the ideas of what and the questions, the definition of what family and legacy are. And it has been a game that ever since I have played it, it is a game that I've thought about ever. Like, I will just randomly think, oh, right. Like, I will encounter something that reminds me of one of the vignettes. It is a game that has been on my mind ever since I played it. So good. I love it.
If you can't tell, we enjoy this game.
Yeah. This is my game of the year last year. Despite the fact that I played PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds probably 1,000% more hours. I played Edith Finch for maybe six hours with two playthroughs. And
I'm in the same boat.
Yeah, PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds, a multiplayer shooter, I played for 250 hours. This is still number one. This is still, and frankly, it is one of my favorite games of all time. It made that list. It is just intricate and beautiful and sad, and it managed to balance all of those things really well. Oh, okay. Andrew?
Robbie?
What have we not talked about in this game?
We haven't talked about the ending, Robbie.
That's a good point. So after Lewis's scene, we get the story of how Dawn took Edith away. And the Dawn's blow up at her grandmother, at Edie and Edith's great-grandmother, who they left when Edith was 10?
I think she's 11, but
okay,
roughly that age.
Yeah. They don't tell, and Edith doesn't know until the day before they leave, the night before they leave. And Edie tries to give Edith her own journal to read. And then Dawn destroys it before Edith can finish.
And in the process, you experience this half a story from Edie's perspective.
Right. And then Dawn and Edith leave. We learn that Edie died that very night, probably from mixing pills and alcohol. And then we learn that Edith has also died probably during childbirth, and that we are actually experiencing this through her lens of her son, who is reading Edith's journal and who's now going back to do the same kind of journey that Edith did.
And also that Edith's mom, Dawn, passed away. I think the implication is from cancer, right?
Yeah, some sort of long illness, which, you know, cancer is an easy answer for that. I mean, they make it, which is another, like, brutal, like, the game backloads the kind, I think it goes a long way to earn a lot of it, like, it earns a lot of that, and then at the very end, it's just like, here's punch, 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 three gut punches kind of in a row at the end of, like, Lewis's scene, and then the blow up with Edie, and then Dawn dying. It's all just like, oof, really rough, and you're oof.
It's a lot all at once.
It's very hard, but it is, I don't know, it when you find that Edith's son, I mean, he is old enough, I don't know how old he is, you don't really know, he is old enough to travel by himself, theoretically.
I would guess, like 12 or 13, like frankly a little too young to travel by himself, but that just from the view we get of him from the back, like I would guess around that age.
Yeah, it's hard to say, but he is about to do the same thing that Edith did. He is about to go back to the house and, you know, memorialize his mother. And it has that kind of, I didn't like it at first. I didn't like the ending at first.
What didn't you like about it?
It felt very sudden to me.
I can see that. It's a different kind of presentation than the rest of the game.
Right. And playing it for the second time and thinking about it more, I feel like I understand why they did what they did. I feel like those choices make sense to me. It's supposed to feel abrupt, I think. It is supposed to deliver all that emotion, and I think it rips a lot of the fantasy away.
It is a far more prosaic end for these people than turning into a frog and going down the drain or being consumed by a sea monster.
Right. It is not sexy. It is not glorified. It is, oh yeah, Edith died and now her son is going to go do, and like that ending is also, it, you know, that has the, of, has that idea of, whoa, this kid is not escaping his name. You know,
the cycle continues.
He is doing, all we can hope is that he is luckier than his mother, but he has the broken arm already. Can't be that lucky.
And especially if I didn't catch this, but if, especially as you point out, that Calvin had the broken leg, like it hints that if there's a curse, it may not be something supernatural. It may be something about the Finch blood, something in the Finch DNA that compels them to do these kinds of things and leads them into trouble. And that as much as they may want to escape it, none of them can.
Yeah. And I think that's all those things compound upon them, upon each other, and made me kind of go like suffer like a bit of whiplash. Playing it through a second time, I was more prepared for those things. And I think that's what ultimately made me go, okay, I get it. You know, it is abrupt, but I feel like it's not bad design or a bad artistic choice. It is purposeful, you know, that they didn't enter into this. I feel like nothing in this game is not placed or written or created without purpose. I feel like everything has a purpose.
Nothing feels accidental from the way that the games are, or pardon me, from the way that the vignettes are spaced to how they progress from one to another to the different choices in telling each story, right? Everything feels very deliberate to try to convey the themes and the message of the game.
And like, I think that ultimately I agree. I didn't like it at first, but now I kind of have like a very grudging respect for it. I'm like, it's not like how will they necessarily tell you to end stories. They, you know, you're supposed to ease people into things, but the game I think earns the right to do what it does.
Agree. It spends a lot of time giving you these lovingly crafted narratives that there's an intention behind delivering the story in a different way at the very end. And that contrast gives it some of its power.
Right. Whew.
That's a lot. It's a lot, man.
It is a lot. I don't know. I can't say enough good things about it. Is there anything else you want to touch on that I haven't brought up, Andrew?
I mean, we could delve into the symbols. Like, I have different theories about what the deer means and what happened to various people, but I think it's just part and parcel with the richness of the game that you can delve into each little thing about, you know, what does the balance of cleaning supplies versus books all over the place mean? What does the way that the rooms seem to get less and less well built and less nicely defined mean? There's enough here to chew on for hours and hours still.
Yeah, it has a lot. The narrative depth is not only what characters say and what characters do, and even how the vignettes play as a video game. It is not just how fast you move as Edith. It is not just the different paths you can walk around the house. It is also the small little tiny details of Chinese delivery being everywhere, of there being a lot of food, a lot of cans of fish from the cannery because they got it for free because Lewis worked there. There's the deer that Edith sees. There's the fact that how the construction of the house is about how when you go down into the basement, you see the workshops. You understand, like, it. There's just everything about it. Everything about it is adding layer after layer after layer of complexity, and I don't know. I feel like it felt like this game was like purposely crafted for me. It feels like this is like the video game god out there in the universe pulled this and just gave it to me and said, here, this is explicitly for you. They're like, everything about the game is a thing that I love in art. And then it combines and melds all those things and then pays such close attention to detail and everything. So good. So good.
Sounds like frustration, Raleigh.
I'm frustrated that I can't do things this good, and two, I wish there was more things like, there are more video games like this. I mean, the video games are, it's never been a better time to be playing video games. Don't get me wrong. I'm just saying, kind of, there can't, every game can't have this kind of narrative depth. It just, a lot of people haven't gotten past the fact that video games shouldn't, or we don't need them in video games. But this is, it pushes story. This game pushes the boundaries of what storytelling in video games can be, and that's another reason it has earned my respect, not just because it's good art.
Well, maybe the critical attention and renown that this game is getting will inspire others to try the same sort of thing.
I'm sure it will. I mean, and there's just a constant. We are reaching, like, it feels like we are in the era of video games like film was in the 70s, of a lot of people like getting access to the means and making very crazy, experimental, different things. Or maybe even the indies filmmaking boom of the 90s. Like, it feels like that. It feels very much like it's like it's an explosion in a lot of different kinds of video games that push envelopes in lots of different ways. And this is one of them. And I'm really excited about what this team does next. I really, like, whatever their next game is going to be, I'm going to buy it and play it immediately. And I hope if it's half as good as this game, I'll be thrilled. Andrew.
Robbie.
What's some things people should check out?
Well, as always, you can find all my writing from all across the web, which is my website, theandrewblog.net. It's three words, theandrewblog.net. And you can find me on Twitter, at theandrewblog. And you can find my writing on TV and film, and even ever so rarely, music as well, at Consequence of Sound. And thank you, as always, for having me on to talk about various nerdy things.
It's always a pleasure. I'll have links to all that stuff in the show notes. I think that'll do it for us today. Thank you for joining me, Eric. I do this. I swear I got. I call people Matt. I call people Eric. I podcast too much. Thank you for joining me, Andrew.
Well, thank you very much there, Robbie. I appreciate it.
That was good.
I think I killed Robbie.
That was good. That was good. I enjoyed it. Thanks again to Andrew for joining me. You can find me on Twitter at Robbie Dorman, and the show's website is SerialFanaticist.com. You can follow our Facebook page at Facebook.com/SerialFanaticist. If you like the show, please give it a 5-star review on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Google Play Music, wherever you listen, whatever podcast service you use, whatever podcatcher you use. Use their recommendation system. Tell us about it. Tell your friends about the show. I appreciate it. Helps get new listeners. I do thank you for any effort you make. Until next time, thanks for being a fan.